Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
This is Tex Lurzel.
And we be drinking and we be swearing.
We sure do.
We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many that is still out here doing its thing, and we'd like to acknowledge that. This is a show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
Heck yes.
Right? Boom.
That's how we do.
We're doing it.
Today, we are drinking a fancy-ass cocktail from 2006 called a penicillin. Or actually, it was created in 2005. I'm so sorry. The penicillin was created in 2005, which was the early days of the resurgence of American cocktail culture. I've talked about this a little bit before on the show, but before Prohibition, cocktail culture was rich and thriving and diverse and storied all the way up until Prohibition. But basically, after Prohibition, that culture just completely disappeared, almost completely gone. Hmm. The only thing that even really came close to that after we were allowed to drink legally in America again was tiki culture. But that didn't even really compare to how rich and how much there was going on.
Yeah, tiki culture was just everything was mixed with juice, yeah. Right? It wasn't that fancy.
I mean, they were getting really fancy and there was a lot going into like presentation and sort of like flair behind the bar.
Okay.
But everything was sort of rum-based and fruit-based for sure. So you're definitely right about that. We didn't really get that old 1800s pre-prohibition cocktail culture back and the showmanship and the... Like, it was just so involved. There were so many different kinds of drinks being made. And, you know, like I said, it was really, really fun. There was a lot going on. And that didn't really come back until the early 2000s.
Wow.
Yeah. I know.
That's a long pause.
In the early 2000s, in New York City, cocktail culture exploded almost overnight. And suddenly there were all of these fancy pants.
Oh, no. Was it Sex and the City?
No, no, no. They came later. Yeah.
You're right. Okay.
Or no, they did. I guess they were, but it was not because of them in any way whatsoever.
Okay, good.
No, no, no. No. But there were all these sort of like fancy pants cocktail lounges with like young, slick, hip bartenders slinging these like really cool pre-prohibition era cocktails. Like before, you would think like the oldest, coolest cocktail you could have is something that was made during Prohibition.
Like Manhattan.
Yeah. Or like a Bee's Knees or something. But these people were making recipes from the 1800s, you know what I mean? And it was like really all of a sudden like the coolest, newest thing that you could do to make a recipe that was 150 years old.
Wow.
And they were bringing back these techniques and ingredients that hadn't been used in 100 years. So today, if you go out to drink or you go out to a bar, when we can go back to bars, it's really easy to see the variety and the choice on a menu when you go to a fancy cocktail lounge and think like, it's always been like this. This is how it's always been. But that was definitely not the case. This is a relatively recent phenomenon.
I did not know that.
I think we both kind of turned 21 after this, after this happened. In these early years of the sort of cocktail resurgence in New York City, in the Lower East Side, there was a bar called Milk and Honey. It's still there, actually, Milk and Honey.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely went there when I first moved here.
I think they opened it, I think it was 2000 they opened. And they created this cocktail called the Gold Rush that was sort of like their most popular, or one of their most popular cocktails. Essentially, it was a whiskey sour sweetened with honey instead of simple syrup. A few years later, like that cocktail blew up. They had it on the menu all the time. People loved it. And a few years later, in 2005, a 22-year-old Australian bartender that worked at Milk and Honey named Sam Ross decided he was going to start tinkering with the Gold Rush recipe. He decided to cut the honey syrup in half and substitute half of it with fresh pressed ginger juice that was sweetened with honey.
That fancy bitch. Yeah.
Apparently that was something they used a lot for other cocktails. They just happened to have this fresh pressed ginger juice sweetened with sugar there. So he was like, I'm going to cut the honey with this. But then he didn't stop there. He decided to swap the bourbon in the Gold Rush for a mellow blended scotch. And he didn't stop there either.
Okay.
To play with the aroma of the drink, he decided to add just a tiny bit, just a quarter of an ounce of a really smoky single malt scotch and float it over the top of the drink. So this way, when you raise the glass to your nose or your mouth, the first thing you take in is the smell of that really smoky scotch. And that hits your nose before you ever taste the ginger, the spiciness of the ginger, the tartness of the lemon, mm-hmm. the sweetness of the honey. So it creates this sort of complex, a little bit weird drink that's almost kind of like intellectual. But that's what they were doing in 2005.
I'm so intrigued. I can't wait to try this.
Yeah. Well, let's take a sip.
Yeah.
So it's supposed to kind of play with your palate a little bit.
Cheers.
Oh, yeah.
Here we are.
You definitely smell that smoke. Ooh.
Whoa.
It's spicy.
That is from delicious. The ginger. Yeah.
Right?
Ooh.
Oh, that's
it's
really good.
It's very spicy.
Yeah.
And very smoky.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can taste the smoke in my mouth.
It's because it's on top.
Afterwards.
So there's only, like I said, only a quarter of an ounce of that smoky single malt just on top.
I like the bitterness together with like the spicy.
Mm-hmm. There's a reason it took off.
They did all the things.
Yeah.
And I applaud them.
So they named it the penicillin because it contains honey, lemon, and ginger, which are all flavors that we're used to having when we're sick. Things that are in like a cough drop or a medicine.
This is very intellectual.
Yeah.
Wow.
The penicillin, he just came up with it and kind of like was like, hey, try this. And like if people would come in that wanted to try like Bartender's Choice, he would make it for people, but it wasn't even on the menu. It was just an off menu, sort of like a New York secret. Like if you were in the know in the cocktail scene in 2005, you would go to Milk and Honey and like ask, like, make me a penicillin.
Wow.
But it didn't take long for other bartenders, because at this time there were so many of these kind of like cool, trendy cocktail lounges that other bartenders were like, oh, have you had the penicillin at the Milk and Honey? So
yeah.
They would go and try it. And then people were trying to recreate it and put it on their own menus.
Mm.
So by 2006, it was starting to explode. And then the next thing you knew, this shit was everywhere.
Wow.
I was reading about one cocktail historian was like, the first time I had it in Germany.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Oh, like, my God.
Yeah.
What?
So one cocktail historian actually said that the penicillin is the most well-traveled and renowned new cocktail of the 21st century.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, but yeah. it sounds right.
Some like random 22-year-old bartender
wow.
came up with this. Yeah.
That's amazing, though.
So the one thing is, if you're going to make this at home, every week we tell you drink along with us at home.
Don't do it.
If you're going to make this at home, most of the recipes that you're going to find online call for a honey ginger simple syrup. But like I said, when they were making this in the bar, originally it was made with a fresh pressed ginger juice that was sweetened. So I knew that didn't quite sound right. And we have a bartender friend, our friend Zan, who has actually been bartending in New York since 2005. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, does this ginger simple syrup sound right to you? And he was like, absolutely not. He's actually friends with Sam Ross, who invented this drink.
Whoa.
So he said, there's no way that you're ever going to get the correct amount of spicy heat and intensity from the ginger if you're just making a simple syrup. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, you have to have this fresh pressed ginger juice, which clearly is a pain in the ass if you're trying to make this at home. I happen to have a vegetable juicer, which is what they would have had in the bar and how they were getting their juice. If you're lucky enough to live somewhere that has a juice place, like in the neighborhood, you can go ask them to juice the ginger for you.
Mm.
I've even seen bottled ginger juice in the store before.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
But if you really want to try and do it yourself at home, you can try and grate the ginger.
And like squeeze it out, right?
Yeah, and then squeeze it out with like a cheesecloth or through a strainer. It's a good drink, though. I think there's a reason that it's so popular and blew up so much. It's very, very quintessentially 2006.
Yeah.
I asked Zan, like, is there one drink that if I had to make a cocktail from 2006, what would it be? And he immediately, without skipping a beat, said the penicillin.
I love it. Zan is like a drink scholar.
He literally is. Every time we have a party.
Oh, my God.
Zan makes a punch. He comes and he's like, I just need you to squeeze like 4 gallons of lime juice and I'll be there.
Yeah.
It's funny because my sense of smell has not fully returned to me yet. And alcohol still kind of tastes a little off. And I was really worried about this drink and it tastes delicious.
It's so good.
Yeah.
I'm so good. And I'm so happy that you can taste it. All of my favorite flavors.
Honey, ginger, and lemon and scotch.
When I was a kid at school, learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, If you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
All right.
So your scandal's from 2006.
Yes. I hop around a little bit, as okay. we usually do, but the bulk of it is from 2006. So this year, or Christmas time this year, I mailed out some holiday cards, as I usually do. Every year I send cards to family and friend, because I'm an old woman.
Yes.
And that's how I like to do.
Same. My favorite holiday card was from your mom, who sent me 3 pounds of glitter.
So as a much gift. Glitter.
I love it, though. I love that she has my address now and I have hers. Like, yes. Brenda, you fucked up. So much glitter.
The best part of my mom's card, my mom is a calligraphy, like,
master. Oh, my God. You're right. Her handwriting, Brenda, wow. It looks like she's writing with a feather.
A quill, yeah.
Yes, it is incredible.
Yeah.
The flourishes, I'm like, oh, wow.
That's how she just signs her name every day. Like, at Wegmans on the keypad, like.
I am a Neanderthal. Yeah. Like, I can't, like, my joints don't move that way. And you're right. That was the most impressive thing. It wasn't just the glitter. It was the handwriting.
I know. It's crazy.
Oh.
I have, like, a doctor's handwriting. I'm chicken scratch.
I do at least in my whole name, like, 4 letters. Yeah, you know, it's just like. That's me. Shut up.
But so this year I mailed these cards, and I didn't know this at the time, but I found out later that the cards that I sent to my family in Virginia didn't reach them for 6 weeks. I sent them in the beginning of December. They didn't get in there until almost the end of January. And then our friends at the Hashtag History Podcast, they actually sent us a holiday card that we didn't receive until middle of January. It turns out that this was happening around the country. Lots of people have been dealing with this.
Just this year, though?
Yes, just this year. So you've probably heard in the news about the new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy. Before being installed as Postmaster General, he gave millions to the Trump
campaign. I'm sorry.
Campaign.
When I hear Postmaster General, for some reason, my mind auto-corrects to Funkmaster Flex. It's not okay.
Yes. Trump's... I can't even say it without cracking up.
I didn't know that there was a Postmaster General.
Yeah,
that's
he's like the head of the Postmaster
General. Okay,
post
that makes
office.
Sense. Yeah. Like Attorney General, Postmaster General. Like, yeah. I know that there was fuckery afoot with the post office, but I didn't know that there was a Postmaster General on the ones and twos.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So before being installed as Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy gave millions of dollars to the Trump campaign and was very vocal about his support for privatizing the post office.
Yes, I do know about this.
And then he was installed as postmaster last June. Before he took power, even during the pandemic, all through the spring, all through the summer, on-time delivery rates for first-class mail were at about 90%. So 90% of things got there on time. Even as mail carriers were coming down with COVID and this kind of stuff, mail was making it to people 90% of the time on time. After Louis DeJoy was installed as Postmaster General, that number fell to around 38%.
What?
38%. He has been very vocal about intentionally slowing down the mail because he's...
Because of the election?
Well, there's a lot of debate about that. And he says no. He says that he was doing it to, like, save the post office money or whatever, whatever. Because he's like, it's just a loaded... malarkey, if you will.
You guys can't hear my face, but it's all scrunched up.
Yeah.
In disagreement and what?
Yeah. To go from 90% to 38% in like a matter of
months. And still
keep
your job?
Yeah.
Hmm.
So currently, right now, he's been in the news a lot. He's been before hearings because Biden and the Democrats
Good.
Are trying to get rid of him. I'm going to talk about this at the end, but okay. Basically because the Postmaster General is not a member of the president's cabinet, he can't be fired by the president. I'll get into that later in this story. But so there is actually an even bigger problem that has been destroying the United States Postal Service from the inside out for the last 15 years. So today I'm going to be talking about something that none of you have probably ever heard of before. The Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006.
I know everything about this. I don't. That was a lie.
But first, I would like to propose a toast. So raise a glass, take a sip, to the idea that people should benefit from their government and not the other way around.
I'm already so upset.
Yes.
This is not...
Louis DeJoy is really not the focus of my story at all. I just thought he would be a good place to open. So before I can really get into the story, I have to give you a little bit of history because that's just how we do. Informing the post office, there was a lot of debate between the founding fathers about whether the post office should be run as a business and expected to turn a profit, or if it was going to be run as a public service that benefited the country, whether it made money or not. George Washington's side of the argument won that argument, and the post office was set up in the hopes that it would somehow bind together the people that were scattered all throughout this country.
Yeah, I like it.
No matter how far or no matter how remote they were, the idea was that we were going
everyone
to be able
should
to...
be connected.
Yeah, exactly. So the whole idea of the post office, you could say, was about more than just the idea of delivering mail. It was about trying to build a national sense of community and identity. In the centuries since the post office was founded, in their sort of reach to deliver mail to the most remote corners of the country, they actually helped make it possible for this country to expand. Now, whether that's a good thing or not is a matter of debate. And we could definitely argue for against it. But that's the fact. The post office helped make this country grow. Not only because they were helping to strengthen the nation's connections with its rural and remote communities, but also because the post office had a government-given right to build new post roads and new transportation systems that made it possible for them to deliver the mail easy, but also the entire country benefited from those roads. The Postal Service would build a road so that they could do their job, but then everybody got to benefit from
it. Whoa. Wow, I did not know that they were building roads specifically for the post office.
Yeah, to deliver mail. That was written into...
I just assumed that they were using roads that were already available.
They were literally building new roads.
What the fuck? Yes. Okay, well, it's a public good then.
Exactly.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And not only that, they were also investing in new forms of transportation. Anytime like a new form of transportation came out, they were like, we need to invest in this because it's going to help us do our job better and faster. Postal contracts helped subsidize the construction of transcontinental railways. They helped subsidize steamboats. And it was even the post office, not the military, that convinced the government to finally invest in commercial aviation.
Because, what?
Yeah, because they were like, we can deliver mail by air if you guys make commercial aviation possible.
Wow. So they've changed just the fabric of American life.
Literally. As a public service.
My mind is blown.
Yeah, literally.
Like, and you just started. Yeah. Like, I haven't even...
My outline was so long when I first started writing this because there was so much backstory about the post office that I wanted to talk, and I had to cut so much of it because it's so interesting the way the post office shaped this country.
Send me your notes.
Yeah.
Send me everything you cut.
Yeah. So when the post office was originally formed and set up, how it would work was that one post office would send mail to another post office. The plan was if I were to send you a letter and you lived in a different state, I would go to the post office and give them the letter, and then you would have to go to the post office and pick the letter up.
Okay.
Eventually, though, home delivery was added at a staggering cost to the nation because it was seen as something that the entire nation could benefit from.
Yeah.
In years that the post office ran on a budget deficit, Congress just kicked in taxpayer money because this was an essential and beneficial service.
If we can give money to Raytheon, I think we can give money to the post office.
It was, I mean, all the things they were doing, they created jobs, they benefited the economy.
Created fucking roads.
Yeah, literally.
It created new businesses that could be on those roads.
Exactly.
Fuck off. This is insane.
Yeah. In 1911, the post office got into banking. Because the government wanted a way to help rural and underserved communities have access to bank accounts. During the Depression, people were terrified about the idea of losing money in private banks that could go insolvent.
Yeah.
So people just went to the postal bank because it was government run. And it was immeasurably helpful for the nation during the Depression to have the postal bank. In 1941, the Postmaster General wrote that postal savings had become America's biggest bank. Unfortunately, after years of neglect and underfunding, In the 1960s, the post office was struggling with a backlog of deliveries. They were getting really backed up because they didn't have enough people, they didn't have enough money, equipment was failing, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So in 1966, Lyndon Johnson closed the postal banking, like shut it down, in the name of streamlining the post office so that they could get back to their core goal of delivering mail. What they should have done was just hired more people, because the post office is a public service, and the government should have known that what the post office needed was more staff.
Yeah.
And the post office has been creating good middle-class jobs in America for centuries. In 2019, they employed over 600,000 people nationwide.
Whoa.
And those jobs have been particularly important to communities of color, mm-hmm. who have been historically kept out of middle-class jobs.
Yes.
After the government desegregated federal jobs, the post office quickly became one of America's earliest and biggest incubators of the black middle class. They've also created a ton of employment opportunities for women, including my own mother, mm-hmm. who just retired from the post office this past November.
Yeah, congrats.
She was a single mom raising three kids on mm-hmm. her own and was able to provide a very comfortable privileged life yeah. for me and our family.
I have a coworker who was a single mom for a really long time, and she worked for the post office mm-hmm. and she was able to provide for her child
yeah.
in New York yeah. City.
Which is crazy. It's yeah. so expensive to raise kids in New York City. Yeah. The post office also has a mandate to give hiring priority to military veterans.
Oh, that's
who
great.
Usually have a really hard time finding
yes.
employment after their
Actually,
service.
Actually, that pulls into my story a little
oh, really?
Bit. Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, military people, because they put their lives on hold.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they come back and they don't
Nobody
have...
Nobody wants to hire them. Yeah.
Nobody wants... It's like... Ugh, yeah, I will save this for my scandal.
Today, the post office employs about 100,000 veterans. A congressional commission once said that the post office existed not for generating revenue, but for, quote, elevating our people in the scale of civilization and binding them together in patriotic affection.
Wow.
All of that changed, though, when Congress passed the Postal Reorganization Act of 1970. This new law removed the Postmaster General from the president's cabinet and downgraded the agency from the Federal Post Office Department to an independent federal agency known as the United States Postal Service, or USPS.
Oh.
That didn't happen until 1970.
Okay.
This new USPS system, they were supposed to operate as a government-owned company. And for the first time in history, they were expected to generate enough revenue to pay for themselves.
They weren't a government-owned company.
Well, it wasn't run as a company, period.
Period, okay.
It was run
okay.
as a public service, but okay. now it was run as a business. And they were expected to pay for themselves, to bring in enough money to pay for their own operations without any help from the government. At the same time, though, they were still subject and are still subject to congressional oversight. So they're in this very strange position where they're expected to make a profit, but they do not have the power to raise prices, to add new services,
what?
To change staffing levels without congressional permission.
That's not how a business is run.
Right? So for decades after this change, the post office, or the USPS, actually did run relatively okay. Things were going all right. They were regularly turning a profit, even through the 1990s when they were shipping out all those AOL CD-ROMs.
Amazing. Oh my God, yes.
Do you remember when you
how could I forget?
The CD-ROM in the mail?
They were ubiquitous.
And, yeah,
like,
and then you
yeah.
got to have the internet.
Yeah, wow. Those CD-ROMs are like fossilized somewhere
totally.
In
yeah.
the landfill.
Yeah.
There are people dusting them off with something that looks like a makeup brush.
Totally.
They're so old.
Cover it.
My mind is blown.
I know. Even after 1993, when the word email started entering the American lexicon, the post office was still making a profit. But then in 2006,
wow.
something truly devastating happened to the post office, and it didn't come from the internet, and it didn't come from their
Wait,
competitors.
What? Oh, no.
It came from a law passed no. by Congress, supposedly in an effort to help them out.
Why do they need help? They're doing fine?
Because Congress had already fucked them, and they were trying to fix it.
Oh, Jesus.
So before I can really get into the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006, I have to go back to another even lesser known bill from 2003 called the Postal Pension Reform Act. In 2001, The Government Accountability Office, also known as the GAO, issued a report to Congress putting the USPS on their high-risk list. Because, according to them, the post office was having trouble with declining revenue and rising debts and increased competition, mm-hmm. especially from email.
Yes.
So they were like, things are terrible. It's the worst. And then in 2002, the U.S. Comptroller General, who, by the way, just happened to be desperate to convince Congress to privatize the USPS, testified before the Senate that the post office had major liabilities that he estimated at close to $100 billion. And he and the GAO together said that they were especially concerned about what the USPS owed to their employee pension fund. So Congress is like, oh, wow, okay, this is really, really scary stuff. Like, something is clearly wrong here. We need to figure out what's going on. We need to conduct a review of the post office and what the post office owes to the Civil Service Retirement System, which is essentially the pension system for federal employees. There are a few key differences between a normal pension and the CSRS, but I'll get into that in a moment. Almost everyone who was going to be involved in this review of the post office and what they owed expected that once they looked into the books, they were going to find that things were even worse than the GAO and the Comptroller General were saying. They thought that the post office's finances were going to be in a complete shambles and that they were going to need a bailout and all this stuff. But once they actually dusted off the books and looked into things, they realized that Congress had actually made a miscalculation in the way this pension fund payments were calculated. And because the pension fund had invested in treasury bonds that were earning even more interest than expected, they were actually overfunding the pensions.
You can't have that.
By a lot.
Ooh.
By like between $70 billion and $100 billion, depending on how you do the calculations.
I love it.
So this sounds like a great thing, right? This sounds wonderful. The GAO can shut the fuck up and move on.
Thank you.
And the post office can slow down their payments into the pension fund.
Yeah.
And then reinvest that money in capital improvements.
Exactly.
Or new trucks and equipment.
Seems like a win-win-win.
Exactly, right?
Mm.
But
oh.
Because the post office is in this weird position where they're this sort of like quasi-government agency / private business.
Is there any other agency that's
no,
like...
not a single one. To fix this overfunding problem would require Congress to change the way these pension payments were calculated in the first place. Even though they were the ones that had miscalculated it, that made this overfunding problem to begin with, they had to take action to fix it. The problem there is that unlike a normal pension, payments to the Civil Service Retirement System go directly into the United States Treasury. And they're withdrawn later, but before they're withdrawn, the government can do whatever the fuck they want with that money. It's their money to play with until it's withdrawn. So Congress realized that if the USPS reduced their payments into the Treasury would actually lose over $4 billion a year.
Ooh.
And over 10 years, that could increase the federal deficit by as much as $41 billion.
We need that money in Afghanistan.
Exactly. Yeah. There are some poor brown children we need to kill with a drone today.
They're like just living their lives happily. Oh. Come on.
So even though that money should have never been in the Treasury in the first place.
There's just like no accountants in the Treasury.
I don't.
That's like,
I mean,
seeing this extra billion.
I don't think the calculator was invented until 2007.
You're right. Let me shut up because I'm stupid.
But so Congress was worried that this new massive hole in the Treasury was going to look really embarrassing for them. So instead of doing the right thing, they just came up with a really creative way of making sure the post office could not get their money back and had to keep paying.
Could not get their money back?
That had to stay in the Treasury.
Oh.
Until they were able to withdraw it. But yeah. Okay. This is when we came to the Postal Pension Reform Act of 2003. Now, keep in mind, the post office has a legal obligation to give military veterans hiring preference. And they employ over 100,000 veterans nationwide. So Congress said, hey, you know what? We fucked up. We fucked up these calculations. It's totally our fault. We're so sorry. We want to fix it. We're going to let you guys reduce your payments into this pension fund. Isn't that great? Aren't we just the best?
Uh-oh.
But by the way, while we're at it.
Oh, no. No, by the way. No, yes. While we're at it.
While we're at it, you guys are now fully responsible for fully funding military pensions for postal employees.
What?
That's a great question. Because where else is that money going to come from? So before this, if you were a veteran, the Treasury...
I have to go.
Yeah.
I need to get out of here.
No.
Okay, go on. I'm sorry.
So before this, if you were a veteran, the Treasury at least partially funded your military pension.
Obviously.
Because that's, yeah.
Because duh.
Yeah, no matter what you did afterwards, the Treasury funded your pension. But this new law said that if you went and got yourself a job at the USPS,
the
Treasury was completely off the hook, and the USPS had to make up the difference. So overnight.
Oh my God,
The USPS owed almost $30 billion in back payments to the Treasury. 2003.
This is terrible.
Yes. Because they had to cover these military pensions and
they had the money though.
I know.
This is so upsetting.
Now they had to pay in installments to make up this $30 billion payment. They had to pay in installments of $1.5 billion a year into the Treasury to make up the difference. So if Congress had just accepted that they had fucked up, they had made an accounting mistake, and returned that extra money to the USPS, the post office could have used it to make capital improvements, buy new trucks, sorting machines, avoid a rate increase for Americans. They could have expanded the range of products and services and found new ways of increasing profits.
But they wanted to make it private.
But this is how a private business runs.
Yeah.
Private businesses reinvest in themselves. It's their money to use to reinvest in themselves and improve themselves so they are more competitive.
Yeah. You shouldn't have to go to Congress to ask for changes.
Yeah. With your own money.
Yeah.
No. Congress is like, no, that's not what you get to do with this money. To avoid embarrassing us because we fucked up, we're screwing you over. Literally screwed the USPS over. Big time.
I mean, wow. Yes. It's so much.
Yeah.
It's so much. It's like so much wrong that I'm just like, what? Like I feel overloaded.
I know.
Is it because like people who want the USPS to be private are like writing laws?
I don't actually know if that was the real. I really think that Congress just didn't want to admit
to be embarrassed.
They made a mistake. And
yeah, didn't want to admit that they don't know math good.
That money shouldn't have been in the Treasury in the first place. So they could have said, hey. Yep. We did a great thing. Yeah. We put all this extra money in the Treasury. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Instead of saying like, oh, now we're going to take that money out of the Treasury. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, after this happened, a few years go by, but then the post office is starting to really feel the effects of people using emails. People are starting to pay their bills online more often. So USPS profits are really starting to dwindle in a big way. They're still making a profit, but that margin is getting narrower and narrower and narrower every year.
They're being set up to fail.
Yeah, exactly. But so at this point, Congress starts rethinking things and like, oh shit, like maybe we did you guys dirty.
Maybe?
I know.
Maybe we did.
Maybe we need to try and find a way to fix this. So this is when we finally get to the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act of 2006.
Oh, God.
So you're following me so far.
Yes.
This is such a complicated
story. It is very complicated, but
it took me so long to write this
outline. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, I'm still horrified and really mad.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of scotch that I'm going to drink my feelings.
Yeah. I'm managing to drink between breaths.
Well, I have to go next.
Yes.
So I'm trying to moderate a little.
In 2006, a bipartisan group in Congress decided that they needed to help the post office out. They saw what was happening. They saw what was going down. And they were like, okay.
Wait, I'm sorry?
Yeah.
A bipartisan Congress?
Yes.
What?
I know. Before Trump.
I'm like, dear diary.
Yeah. Before Obama.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Because they can't work with a black man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They came up with this plan to reform the USPS in a way that hadn't been done since 1970. This was supposed to be a really big deal. This was supposed to be so good, not just for the post office,
You're
but for the entire country.
It's not so good. Okay.
No, not so good.
Oh, no.
Not only was the plan to reverse the decision to fully fund military pensions, But they also wanted to make it so that they could give the post office more power to self-regulate, more flexibility in pricing.
Good.
So that they could Absolutely. Become more a real competitive business. In yeah. the future. Yeah, exactly.
If you want them to be a real business, let them be a real business.
Exactly. But they can't let them do everything like that. So in the name of streamlining and efficiency, they also wanted to narrow the definition of services that the post office could offer and literally, by law, prohibit them in engaging any new activities or revenue streams outside of mail delivery.
They didn't want them to have a bank again or something?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or any other, like, there's a lot of things that they could do, but you can't do anything other than deliver mail and packages. So getting rid of this obligation to fund military pensions is...
That's huge. Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
It's going to save them $61 billion over 10 years.
Oh, fuck. Okay.
$61 billion.
Whoa.
So the legislation passed almost unanimously with broad bipartisan support. But there was a problem.
Oh,
Before this bill passed, the Bush administration caught wind of the hit that the Treasury Department was about to take because that money was about to stop flowing. You know, despite the fact that the Treasury was being artificially padded with money that shouldn't have been theirs in the first place, that's besides the point. Bush threatened to veto this bill unless that it was, quote, budget neutral, which meant that postal profits needed to keep flowing into the Treasury, or he was going to stop this bill in its tracks.
What?
Yes. He said, not today. No, ma'am. So to make this happen, at the very last minute, the bill's architects threw in a provision requiring the post office to calculate all of its likely retiree health care costs over the next 75 years and then pay for them in advance in installments over the next 10 years at a cost of more than $50 billion. So before this...
I'm so upset.
I know. Before this, the USPS funded retiree health care on a pay-as-you-go basis, as you do. That's when the insurance bill comes in the mail, you pay that shit, and that's how it works. But now, they had to stash away $5.5 billion a year between 2007 and 2016 and continue prepaying for new hire. So, like... Once they stash all that money away over that course of 10 years, as new people were hired, they had to keep prepaying 75 years in advance.
What?
Yes.
How can you do that?
You have to calculate all these, what healthcare could cost in 75 years, given the amount of staffing you have at the current time. It doesn't make any fucking sense.
This is so insane to me.
Yes.
All of this.
It doesn't make no sense.
It don't make no sense. Like, I don't even know what to say.
Yes.
I'm just like, I'm trying my hardest for it to make sense, and it just doesn't.
There are a lot of people, even today, that defend this and say that this is responsible.
How is it responsible?
Because their profits are dwindling, so why not have them pay in advance?
But do they know about this excess money that's just, like, trapped in the treasury?
They don't want to think about that.
But why...
This is responsible, Stephanie.
They have the money.
They're just paying in advance for something they're going to have to pay eventually anyways.
But they can't predict the future.
I know. This literally would be like...
I don't understand.
If you were to say, if you want to take out a 30-year mortgage to buy a house, if the bank were to say to you, you have to have all of that money up front, including... interest.
Yes, including... That's insane.
And then put it into a savings account in the bank that the bank can play with, and you can withdraw your payments from your savings
this
account.
This is a fucking racket, and like, I'm not...
Yes.
No. How is this legal?
Because Congress said so. According to Bloomberg, pre-funding the health benefits of retirees is a requirement that no other entity, private or public, has to make.
It doesn't make any sense.
It makes zero
sense. I don't...
You can't make sense out of nonsense.
Yeah, it's true. One of my mom's iconic phrases.
Yes.
It's true. You can't.
So the committee that was pushing for this bill didn't want to let the bill die because they saw this bill as such a great thing. Even after they pushed these other things into it, they rushed it to the floor and brought it before Congress Congress had time to consider or assess the bill as a whole. The bill went to a vote and passed without objection almost unanimously.
Yikes.
Because it was supposed to be something else.
How is this the way that laws work?
I know.
This is scary.
I know.
Like, what else is going on that we don't know about?
Exactly, yeah.
What the fuck?
Many people consider this one of the worst pieces of legislation that Congress passed in an entire generation. But at the time that it passed, in 2006, the post office was still making a profit every year. So the people that were involved thought, like, it sucks that this is how we have to do it to make this bill pass, but the post office is going to be okay because they're still making a profit. They're still going to be able to make these payments. But the thing that doesn't make any sense to me is
I'm like,
but literally, you are creating this bill to fix the problem of the military pensions.
Yeah.
And then instead of fixing anything, you're just giving them a different problem.
Yes. It's so, like a new hoop to jump through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why bother? Why not just leave it with the military pensions? You're not changing anything. You're just shifting the name of what this debt is that they have. It's changing from one hand to another, but it's still debt that they have to pay artificially to the Treasury. And the only thing that was left over, if you take all the things that self-negate, the only thing that was left over was the part about how they couldn't expand their menu services, of services yeah. without congressional permission. The year that this bill passed in 2006, mail volumes peaked and then started to decline. And then in 2008, we had a little bit of a economic recession and there was a further drop in postal revenue. So the USPS missed their first payment into this healthcare prepayment fund in 2011. They missed their first payment.
Can't believe they've held on this long. I know. That's incredible.
Well, so because the payments are mandatory by law, this is seen as defaulting on a debt. And that debt has been piling up ever since. The USPS lost $62.4 billion between 2007 and 2016. And over 80% of that money, almost $55 billion, was due to the missed payments into pre-funding retiree healthcare. And this has already had a terrible, terrible effect on postal operations. The higher-ups, the powers that be, are using these losses, constantly using them as an excuse to slash the workforce and reduce service levels at the post office. If you've ever been to the post office, it's not a fun experience.
No.
Everyone's miserable. Mm-hmm. Everyone's overworked. Everything sucks.
Yeah.
Even at the good post offices, it's a mess. Mm-hmm. And this is why. One politician and former postal employee said, "Service has been cut to the bone in order to survive. Offices closed, delivery standards cut, hours reduced, and workers placed under unreasonable stress." And my mom can attest to that.
Our post office in North Canton was closed, I think, like 2010.
Closed. Yeah. Closed. A lot of offices have been closed. It's crazy. And the worst part of this whole thing is that it boils down to a manufactured crisis. Mm-hmm. This was set up by Congress. It's little more than financial sleight of hand and a complete lack of foresight. Congress created this problem out of nothing, and unfortunately, it's up to them to fix it.
Good luck.
Also, unfortunately.
Oh, also, what?
Yes.
Also,
unfortunately, a lot of proponents of privatization in Congress are using this crisis now as vindication.
Of course they are.
To say, look, the post office
was always the plan.
Yeah, exactly. I know. But it really, like, this was a bipartisan bill with people who really set about to fix things. They wanted to make things better for the post office. And then Bush was like, no, girl, sorry about it. These proponents of privatization are trying to, like, look, they're failing. It's a mess. Private industry should be allowed to take over and fix it. I don't actually think that will ever happen, though. I do not.
Okay.
Because who's going to make up that giant hole in the Treasury?
Ooh, you're right.
No private business is ever going to agree to that.
Oh, absolutely not.
Never.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And no private business could ever profitably do what the post office
does. No.
They have this universal
future
service mandate.
Like retirement payments?
But
like,
not even that. Just if we got rid of that. But even just what the post office does at its core, they have this universal service mandate to deliver mail to the most remote parts of the country.
Oh, yeah.
We're like way out in the middle of nowhere in Alaska. They have to deliver. It is by law. They have to.
Yeah.
No matter what the cost. Mm-hmm. So no private business would ever be able to do that. The USPS delivers more mail in 16 days. 16 days than UPS and FedEx combined ships in an entire year.
What?
Because we're talking about pieces of mail.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No business can do that.
No.
Yeah, no.
With this universal service
mandate?
Absolutely
not.
No matter what the cost is for these routes in the middle of nowhere?
They run so well.
Considering? Yeah.
I mean, whoa. That's remarkable.
In fact, other carriers like UPS and FedEx actually have a contract with the UPS, and they frequently pass off packages to them to do what they call last mile delivery.
I've noticed that. Yes.
It's for their most expensive routes, especially in rural areas. They say, it's going to be too expensive for us to do this. We'll give you, you know, 5 cents if you deliver this for us. And that's why UPS and FedEx have actually become some of the USPS's biggest defenders in this.
Yeah. Because like we need them.
Yeah. They're keeping them afloat. Yeah. The USPS is keeping these other private delivery companies afloat. Thankfully, even though there are a lot of people in Congress who either haven't considered this fact or don't give a shit about people living in rural areas, there are even more people in Congress who do realize that a huge mess has been made and that it needs to be cleaned up. A bill called the USPS Fairness Act was recently introduced with the aim of eliminating this pre-funding requirement and forgiving all the payments that the USPS has already defaulted
Good.
On. Yes.
Oh, okay.
This bill has more than 300 co-sponsors in Congress, including more than 5 dozen Republicans. So
what?
Another bipartisan bill.
5 dozen?
Yes.
And yet impeachment?
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Louis DeJoy is another hurdle. And as I've said before, President Biden doesn't have the power to fire the Postmaster General because he is not a cabinet member anymore since that Postal Reorganization Act. However, there is a 9-member board of governors of the post office, and they can fire DeJoy. And Biden, for whatever reason, can replace them.
Okay.
So Biden is actually already working on replacing
Good.
The 4 members who are Republican Trump appointees who hired DeJoy in the first place.
He sacked a lot of people when he
exactly.
knew he was losing.
Yeah. It looks like if all goes according to plan and everything goes right, Louis DeJoy should be gone soon. In fact, because I'm hyper aware of what's going on with the post office, because I've been writing this outline, I've been seeing a lot about it in the news lately. Mm. So maybe he'll already be gone by the time this episode actually comes out.
Wow.
I'm hoping.
Okay.
Like, it's in the works.
Really?
However.
Or is your phone just listening
I
to
know.
You?
Well, both. Yeah, both. But even if we are able to get rid of him, and we are able to overturn the Postal Accountability Enhancement Act, that will still not solve all of the USPS's problems because so much damage has already been done by this. Ugh. It's definitely going to help a lot if we get rid of this, but the post office is still going to be losing money. But lately, a lot of people have suggested bringing back postal banking as a possible solution.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. Today, more than a quarter of U.S. households lack access to adequate banking services, and a ton of people lose a ton of money on the fees that they have to pay to payday lenders and check cashing places. This is especially true in rural areas and communities of color.
Yep.
A report was recently commissioned by the USPS Inspector General, and it says that 59% of post offices are located within bank deserts. And if postal branches were able to offer a range of banking services, that could give many American families an average savings of $2,000 a year, while also at the same time bringing in potentially an extra $9 billion in profits into the Postal Service.
Are we doing this now? Like, why?
Many politicians have already voiced support. Kristen Gillibrand, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have all voiced support. And last year, an appropriations package passed in the House that included an amendment to give $2 million for a postal banking trial.
Ooh, hell yeah. Test run.
Yeah, exactly.
But we've already done this?
No,
so
it passed the House.
Oh.
But that was when Mitch McConnell was still in power of the Senate.
That's fine.
So hopefully,
we got this.
Hopefully this is possible.
Yeah.
It's not happening yet, but it's possible. Now, people may say, the post office is already struggling to keep up with package delivery and mail delivery. Why would we add an additional service? Why would we add more services when they're already struggling to do just what they do already? But it's clear that the post office needs to hire more employees anyways.
Yeah.
Even if things stay exactly the same as far as service levels go, they need to hire new people. They have to. It's desperate.
Yeah.
So why not, when they're hiring new people, find new ways of bringing in even more money while also at the same time helping the American public? It's a win-win.
Truly. It's like, I don't understand why this is a debate.
I mean, this is sort of a separate thing, but like, if the post office had had those billions of dollars returned to them 20 years ago and they were able to reinvest in themselves then, we wouldn't be in this situation in the first place. They would probably be thriving if they had been able to reinvest in themselves 20 years ago.
They would be thriving.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, they're running a really tight ship and a great business.
Exactly.
Like, the fact that they've been able to hold on this long.
I know.
Like, just jump through hurdle after hurdle for no reason other than Congress.
I know. And then the people, like, the poor people that actually work there, the face that you see at the window, service levels are cut, people are angry all the time, and like, there's no wonder that everyone is so frazzled when you go in there. Yeah. It's not their fault.
No, never.
They work in this horrible, toxic environment, and it
explains everything.
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, any serious reform of the post office needs to begin with repealing the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act and eliminating that pre-funding mandate. But that should only be the beginning. The USPS needs to be treated as a universal public good and restored as a proper department of the federal government, with the Postmaster General reinstated in the president's cabinet.
Yes. They should have never been demoted to this weird quasi-private, quasi-public.
I know. That's my story.
That's it? Oh, God. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, I can't deal with anything more.
Yeah. The next time you go in the post office, don't get mad at the people that work there.
I never get mad at those people. I get mad at people who are getting mad at them.
Yeah, exactly.
The people who are like sucking their teeth, like, fuck off.
Yeah.
No one wants to be here.
Literally.
And this is unpleasant for everyone, but like, everyone knows how to behave but you.
Yeah. I know from my mom working there, those people are working 60 plus hours a week.
Wow.
And there's no help. It's terrible the way these people are expected to survive.
It's not right. But thank you for that scandal. Oh, my. Yeah. I mean, you've like overloaded my mind.
I know.
And
I know.
Now I have to do my own scandal. What?
Oh, okay. Well, it's cocktail time.
Yes.
Well, hello there. Do you wish your high school history course had more drinking, more swearing, and more ladies?
Well, do we have the show for you. Her Story on the Rocks is a long-form podcast talking about good women, bad women, fictional women, and non-fictional women from all times and places.
Basically, each week we pair two women who we research with a themed signature cocktail.
You won't be sorry you listened to our latest episode.
Available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cheers. Cheers.
That story was a lot.
It sure was. I know.
Are you guys okay?
It's so much.
I'm not okay. Yeah.
It's just a mess. The whole thing is
The whole thing is a mess, and it just doesn't make any sense. So my story is from the 30s. I think I told you that. Your favorite era. Click, click. So on November 21st, 1934, a bombshell article appeared in the failing New York Times. The Times got wind of a coup to overthrow the newly elected but very popular president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh.
Do you know anything about this?
A coup? No, I don't think so.
Okay, so some highfalutin execs and oil tycoons didn't like the cut of FDR's jib.
He has such a great jib. You guys need to stop this.
Seriously. And by jib, I mean his New Deal. So these men wanted to create a fascist military style junta in the U.S., replacing FDR with a handpicked military general.
What?
Exactly. So my scandal is known as the business plot. God. No one knows about this. Yes. Shit is crazy, you guys. Like, buckle your seatbelts. It's a little known story of the Wall Street scheme to launch a fascist coup in the United States of America.
Ah, so it's not the first time.
No. Okay. And we're not just doing this shit in like Central America.
Yeah.
We're doing this in the US.
Wow.
So some of the richest traders in the country banded together to plan for a glorious fascist future. Because elections are stupid, especially when the person that you didn't vote for wins by an undeniable landslide.
Oh, I can't. Stop this the steal.
I hate you. Okay, so before I get into my scandal, we need to do a dose.
You sure do.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Let's raise our glasses to generationally wealthy white men getting away with the highest forms of treason.
Ooh la la.
As is the way of their people. Cheers.
It's tradition, Stephanie.
It is. Just... it is. It's their culture mm-hmm. of wealthy white men.
This Next
is,
you're going to try and this is how wage they do. A war on Christmas.
I like my holidays happy, okay?
I like my holidays gay.
You are waging a bigger war on Christmas than I am. Okay, so some background. FDR was so unpopular with rich people. Did you know that?
Imagine that.
But he was a rich person himself.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like, but why? But as soon as he got elected through inauguration, people were so upset and so scared. It was a wild time. I will give them that. But when FDR, he got into the White House and he announced his plan to employ the unemployed. Mm-hmm. And open up opportunity to all.
Burn him.
Yeah, it was intimidating. It was potentially destabilizing for a country that has like a racial caste system. Yeah. So equality, they were scared of it. We are still scared of it now, it seems. But in order to pay for the New Deal, we had to go off the gold standard for a brief moment.
Yeah. Okay.
We didn't technically go off it fully. I hate monetary policy. I know a lot about it now, and I want to do a separate scandal just on the gold standard.
We've been talking about this since episode one.
I know. We have been. So FDR, he didn't get rid of the gold standard. He just said that creditors could no longer request their payments in gold. They had to accept paper money because there was a run on the banks. Banks were failing left and right, and people were just hoarding their gold.
So did people literally have to pay debts in gold?
Correct.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you could.
But like some creditors would be like, I'm not taking paper money. Give me
ounces of gold.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Wild, right?
Where would you even?
But also you could. There was, I don't want to get into bimetallism, but there was a time when silver was tied to gold. So if you didn't have gold, you could trade in silver.
But so you could just go to the bank and be like, I need gold to pay my bills.
That's how they were living back then. So we needed money to be able to pay people's wages, government wages. People are upset at FDR because he wanted people of all races, technically, and all religions mm-hmm. to be able to have these government jobs.
Sure.
And that rich people were like, no.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not how you do it. So he had the good sense to know that when people were employed, they were going to spend their five monies at the coat store.
Yeah.
You know?
Literally, that's right? what we should be thinking about right now. Because you give all that money to rich people and they just fucking sit on it.
Yeah.
Because they don't need to spend it. They
exactly.
have money already.
He thought that if he can get people back to work and give them purchasing power, they would spend money. Then manufacturing would come back online. Then stores would come back online. And slowly the economy would climb back on the tracks.
Oh, and what happened? It worked.
But all the wealthy could see was that they were being taxed.
Yeah.
To create like a minimum wage, to sure. create all of these social programs that didn't benefit them.
Yeah.
So they were really upset. I found a quote from an exec at DuPont. DuPont was part of this like collusion that I will get into later. Pretty much every big corporation was involved in this plot, this mm-hmm. business plot. It was like DuPont, it was Heinz, it was Maxwell Health. I'm like, no, not coffee.
Shitty coffee.
Not shitty coffee. Yeah. It was Standard Oil, but also like wealthy private citizens were also in it. Prescott Bush was implicated in it. Okay. The grandfather of everyone's favorite creepy portrait artist, mm-hmm. he was in it. So this executive from DuPont, he sent a letter to a friend that read, five Negroes on my place in South Carolina refused to work this spring, saying that they had easy jobs with the government. A cook on my houseboat at Fort Myers quit because the government was paying him $1 an hour as a painter.
So pay them more.
Thank you. If you have two homes, one of which is a houseboat in a different state, bitch, you can pay your cook $1 an hour.
Like, oh, my employees expect enough money to live off of. What the fuck?
Exactly.
They're so lazy.
So lazy thinking that they should be paid for their work for me. Come on. So there was this fear, and it's so counterintuitive and weird. There was this fear that, like, too much democracy, air quotes around that, would lead to communism. This was a time when Asian Americans still couldn't vote. Yeah. Native people couldn't vote. Like, Black people, we know what was happening to them all over the country when they tried to vote. How is this a democracy? Like, it's nonsense. But their big fear was that FDR, through his policies, would make them as poor as everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm not even going to.
Yeah, right?
You can't hear my eyes rolling, but I need to get beads on my eyeballs.
Yeah, you do on maybe your eyelashes, like tiny little beads. So this was the backdrop of the business plot. Fascism was trending in Europe, and it offered this cheap and easy fix for a nation that was in crisis. All you had to do was shape up.
Yeah.
You just shape up and then you get rid of your undesirables and then you get rich. Come on, easy.
Just be rich.
Just already. Be rich. Just be rich already. So it was super, super popular here, not just in Europe. They just chose the wrong man. They wanted a strong man to, like, lead the country into this glorious fascist future, but they chose the wrong person for the job. Huh. Instead of choosing a Michael Flynn-like traitor, they approached a man who actually loved his country, as flawed as it was. He's just like, fuck fascism. Get out of here. So enter, his name is Smedley D. Butler. Smedley. I'm like, I'm not going to say Smedley. I'm just going to call you Butler or the general. So he was a retired Marine Corps general who received 2 medals of honor. He was a vocal advocate for veterans way before there was a VA, before there was a GI Bill, way before we knew anything about PTSD. Mm-hmm. He's just like, we need to take care of these men who fought bravely for this country.
Yeah.
Which, it's sad that that's controversial, but it was kind of, he was the only one really doing this on a national stage. All they had back then before the VA was an organization called the American Legion. Mm-hmm. It was created after World War I to kind of be a veterans union.
Okay.
It was a way for them to use their collective bargaining power and, like, advocate for bills at the federal level.
Okay.
Through the American Legion, veterans were able to push through this bill that granted them bonus pay for their lost wages while overseas.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah. But the whole thing is, I don't want to get into it fully because it's its own scandal. The bonus pay was supposed to be paid in 20 years. This was set into place before the economy fell apart and there was no jobs for anyone, mm-hmm. let alone veterans.
Yeah.
Like they were all on the street almost instantly. You know about Hoovervilles, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. It's one of the few things I actually remember from history class. But you know that they were everywhere and, like, no one really cared. Like, everywhere, everywhere.
As long as they were
away.
Yeah, you couldn't see them. Yeah. It was fine.
Like a tent city, basically.
Yeah, totally. It was a big group of people. Yeah. They would build, like, find whatever scrap wood and canvas and
build
cardboard, whatever.
Yeah.
And build little, essentially, communities together. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were fine as long as they were far, far away from your eyeballs. The Bonus Army. Do you know anything about the Bonus Army? Probably
no.
not. Okay. Mm-mm. So they were a group of 15,000 veterans who marched down Pennsylvania Avenue and camped in front of the Capitol. They put a Hoovervilles right in front
of
the Capitol.
I've heard of this. Yes, I have heard of this.
It's its own scandal. I'm just going to tap dance right on top of it. All you need to know is that they were there and they were requesting the money that was owed to them.
Okay, yeah.
Even though it was an advance payment, they're just like, we need this money now.
Now, yeah.
We can't wait for 20 years.
Yeah,
obviously.
We'll be dead.
We'll be dead.
Yeah.
And our families will be dead.
Yeah.
But they were, like, demonized in the press.
Mm-hmm.
It's disgusting. But President Hoover, because this is prior to FDR, President Hoover was unsure about how he should handle them because, like, the optics of, like, going in there and, like, pushing these veterans who served bravely out of this space felt a little icky. So he was just kind of quiet and just let this thing go for months.
Yeah.
In front of the Capitol. And it started feeling like really menacing and really weird. But General Butler, who is now retired, he was just a private citizen, he was asked to come to the camps to give a speech.
Okay.
And he was fully in support of them. He said that they may call you tramps now, but in 1917, they didn't call you bums, which is true.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's like, how are they bums now? Just because they're out of work like everyone else is? Like, how is this shameful? They're not doing anything wrong. This is...
No, and they're the reason that the country is still, you know, we won the war and blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. He went on to say that the Bonus Army was the greatest demonstration of Americanism that we've ever had. So he encouraged them to just be...
This is the person they chose to run against?
I'm going to get into that. Yes. And this is why it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So every season I do someone who's doing good, who did good things. Uh-huh. He is my person time. Yeah. Again, they chose the wrong one.
Yeah. He sounds like somebody that would get along really well with FDR.
So he gives this speech... And then a few days later, General Douglas MacArthur, do you know anything about MacArthur?
A little bit.
He was called by FDR later the most dangerous man in America.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He was a very wild general.
Yeah.
So a few days after this speech, he arrived with troops to crack skulls. Two people died. One of them was a baby.
What?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's bad. So Butler, he stuck out in stark contrast as a military man who was like doing all the right things, and it made him wildly, wildly popular. Mm-hmm. But this is how he landed on the elites, like these co-conspirators' radar,
because like, everyone loves him. If we offer him power and money, he's gonna come our way or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That was their thought. So there were at this time hundreds of thousands more veterans than active duty servicemen.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. So these elite people thought that if Butler could summon these 500,000, half a million veterans and have them march on Washington, then the government would fall without a shot being fired.
Wow.
So to have this like extended fascist conflict would fuck up their money. So in the summer of 1933, a soldier turned banker contacted General Butler, a man named Gerald McGuire.
Okay.
I'm trying not to call him Jerry McGuire, but he's Jerry McGuire. So this banker named Jerry McGuire tried to convince the general.
I'm trying very hard. I know, right?
So this banker, he tried to convince the general that it would be in the Bonus Army's interest to demand their payment in gold.
Okay. Yes, I see.
Exactly, okay. Right? He then offered to send Butler and other veterans on this like lavish speaking trip in support of the gold standard.
Wow.
McGuire wanted the general to take over the leadership of the American Legion. American Legion, again, is that like veterans union at an upcoming convention in Chicago in September. And he wanted him to like make a speech. So Butler's just like, hold up. I wasn't invited to this convention.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, like what speech? Mm-hmm. Like this don't make no sense. And Jerry told him that, hey, like, I'm on the committee. I'll just put you as a delegate from Hawaii.
Is he from Hawaii?
He's from Pennsylvania. McGuire's like, it doesn't matter. It's fine. We'll get you on the list. His whole plan was like, he told Butler that he could bring 300 to 400 veterans with him. And then the veterans would be at this convention and they would create a disturbance, like be like, Butler, Butler. And he would take the stage and then give a speech.
Okay.
It's so ridiculous. But Butler was horrified by the boldness of this offer. But he decided to play along because he's like, fuckery's afoot. Yeah. And I like want to get to the bottom of this. Like, this is really out there. So he started asking some like logistical questions like, oh, you want like 300 to 400 men? Veterans who are broke as shit to come to Chicago, like how are they going to get to Chicago?
Yeah.
Where are they going to stay? Are they going to have to make a tent city? Like what's going on? McGuire's like, no, we got it. And he's just like, it's all expense paid trip for the veterans.
Oh, so they're paying them to come.
He said that we will cover your expenses.
Okay.
And Butler's
including
just,
all the expenses to house these people.
Exactly.
And transportate.
Yes.
Transportate. They're going to transportate all these people?
Yes. So Butler hears like, wait, we? Who is this we? I'm just talking to you. And then he asks about this speech that he's supposed to give at this conference that he's not invited to.
Yeah.
He's just like, what kind of speech am I going to give? Jerry, pulls a speech out of his pocket.
Oh, here's the speech you're giving.
Here's the speech. Funny that you ask. I got you. Funny that you ask. Here's the speech that you are going to read at this conference in September.
You're very passionate about this subject that I have written for you to be passionate about.
Butler read this speech and he demanded to know, like, who wrote this speech and why was the speech supposedly about soldiers' bonuses so focused on the gold standard?
Yeah.
Make this make sense.
Yeah.
Jerry told him that this speech was written by a lawyer at J.P. Morgan.
Of course.
Right? A man named John W. Davis. But he reassured the general that, like, J.P. Morgan just wanted to make sure that the veterans receive their bonuses. That's a quote.
I'm sure.
Yes.
J.P. Morgan is very, very concerned from his golden throne that these people get their money.
He just wants these veterans to be paid in gold, okay? He's good like that.
We really do need some kind of a sound effect when I roll my eyes.
Yeah,
I need like a little button that I can just press.
Yes.
Eye roll.
Ooh, maybe Tim could help us out. I think that would be so annoying to a listener because it would be every second. It's
literally, that's all the show is just the sound of our eyes rolling.
I want it to be the sound of like a ball rolling off a table and like rolling down the floor. That's the sound of my eyes rolling. So Butler declined this like really sketchy offer because what? But McGuire was totally undeterred. He offered Butler checks on the spot. He had two different checks from Colonel M.P. Murphy and a man named Robert S. Clark as just like a down payment to like get things going.
Okay.
So I don't know the amount of what these checks were for, but Butler knew both of these men because they were soldiers, but they both came from money. One was actually called the Millionaire Soldier. Robert S. Clark, he was the heir to the Singer fortune. Singer as in like sewing the machines. Sewing machine. Yeah. In an era where everyone had a sewing machine,
everyone had a sewing machine.
He had all of the money.
Mm-hmm.
Butler was really suspicious that he's like name dropping these like millionaires, so he decided to string McGuire along for several months to just like get more information.
Good for him! Wow, that's incredible,
right? So good.
What a smart person.
So smart.
Seriously, so many could have been like, "Fuck you," you know. But then they would have just gone to somebody else that would have actually done it.
Correct. Yes.
Wow.
So McGuire visited Butler several more times to sell him on this coup. Every time he's continuing to offer bribes. At one meeting, Butler was kind of egging him on, being like, you keep giving me these checks, but like maybe these checks will bounce. Like maybe it's like a forgery. Mm-hmm. It's not really from like the Singer heir. Like you don't have any money.
So he hadn't cashed any of them yet.
He refused them, but he was just like,
I see.
Yeah, he never took any money.
Good for him.
Yeah. He never took a dime. Never took any of the checks. He was kind of playing it like, you're trying to get me in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I don't believe that you really have any money.
Mm-hmm.
So McGuire actually, and I'm sorry for this, shows him the money.
Shut up.
So McGuire, he continued to just like casually be in the area where Butler was giving speeches, because Butler was retired, so he made his money giving speeches at different veterans associations. He kept being firm in his no. He didn't take any of the money that he was offered, but he allowed Jerry to further implicate himself and hopefully others. Like, it was his goal to reveal the whole network, because McGuire was very cryptic, but he kept kind of slipping up and saying like, we and us.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, who is we and us?
Yeah.
Butler was asking like, hey, can I meet someone else? Like, can I meet Murphy? Can I meet Clark? Why am I just like going through a middleman?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is this real?
I don't trust you.
Exactly. I mean, he was trying to expose the network. And surprisingly, McGuire was like, okay, fine. You can meet Clark. It's fine. So when Butler met Clark, Clark reiterated the same pitch about gathering soldiers and getting back to the gold standard. And Butler was still saying like, okay, this doesn't really add up. Like, what does the gold standard have to do with the soldiers?
Yeah.
What does it have to do with me? Finally, Clark came clean. He said, and this is a quote, he had a fortune of $30 million. He said that these were uncertain times and that if he had to spend half of his money to protect the other half of his money, he would do it. And he said that all of his partners would do the same, even if it meant paying every single bonus of every single officer, veteran.
You know, if you guys just paid your taxes, that would be the same result.
It's so upsetting. So according to Clark, who again is the heir to Singer, he said that FDR was on the verge of destroying everything. But if Butler gave this speech and took control of the American Legion, he could demand a return to the gold standard. And then perhaps this could persuade Congress and then eventually the president to go back onto the gold standard. And Butler asked, like, FDR was just going to abandon his whole program for this. And he asked, like, are these veterans that are loyal to me, are they there to just, like, threaten him?
Yeah.
No. No, not at all. This is a quote. He's like, no, 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 not to frighten him. Now, did it ever occur to you that the president is overworked? And that he might have an assistant president, someone to take the blame. And if things do not work out, he can drop him. You know, the American people will swallow that. We've got the newspapers. We will start a campaign that the president's health is failing. Everybody can tell that by looking at him. And the dumb American people will fall for it in a second.
The dumb American people.
The dumb American people will fall for it in a second.
How many times have people said that behind closed doors? Okay. A second president. So like a vice president, maybe?
A shadow president that they didn't need to know about. FDR is tired. He just needs a break from the responsibilities that all these people voted him in to do. It's such an incredible story, and I love that Butler did what he did and just took all of the notes and kept all of the receipts, and it's, yeah, I'll get to it at the end, but it is damning. So Butler said that he, and this is a quote from him, he did not like seeing soldiers used as pawns to undermine democracy, to which Clark responded like, hey, like, we'll pay your mortgage. We'll pay your kids' tuition. These were things on the table. He said, stop being so stubborn, basically. Yeah. Like, get this money. But the general, he said no. And Clark, he's at his hotel room. So he asked to use the phone. So Clark calls McGuire and tells Butler, like, hey, he's not going to come to Chicago. He's, like, not down with the plan, like, whatever. And he said, we need to go to Plan B. And this is when, like, Butler's ears are, like, perked up, like, Plan B.
What's Plan B? Yeah.
He didn't hear most of the conversation, but he heard the word telegrams. So after the convention, Butler was horrified to discover that telegram pamphlets had fallen from the ceiling during this convention.
Okay.
And in them, a message argued for paying bonuses in gold and returning us to the gold standard.
Okay.
And sadly, and this is so upsetting, sadly, this was enough to get the American Legion to back the gold standard, to request their payments be in gold.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. So it's like when he says, oh, the American people are dumb enough to fall for this, it's like, but people are desperate. That's
the
thing.
It's the Depression.
Yeah, it's a Depression. These people are manipulative, and they're good at what they do.
Yeah.
It's just, it made me kind of sad that that's all it took, like dropping some pamphlets to get them on the side of Wall Street, which is against their own interests.
Exactly.
So in October, the convention was in September. In October, McGuire, he visited Butler again to basically low-key brag about what happened at the convention. Butler reminded him like, hey, you know, these soldiers that you and J.P. Morgan care so much about still haven't been paid. Like, what about that?
Yeah.
He did not have an answer.
Of course.
But he asked like, hey, if you give speeches on the gold standard, we'll pay you $750 for every speech that you give.
Which back then must have been an
insane lot of money. Thousands of dollars. Yeah. Butler said no. And McGuire's like, okay, fine. You don't want to be bribed. He's like, well, can I come with you on tour to these different like VFW locations to potentially recruit other people who are more compliant than Butler? And he's like, no, you can't come with me. Like, fuck off. No. So he didn't hear from McGuire until January of the following year.
Okay.
When he received his first postcard. He received a number of postcards from him January through the spring. So Jerry was all over Europe. And he was sending postcards describing his, quote, family vacation. He went to Italy. He went to the French Riviera. He went to Berlin.
During the Depression.
Yeah, no braggies. In August, 3 days after Hitler officially became the Chancellor of Germany, Butler met Maguire at a hotel restaurant. And Maguire was just obsessively talking about how we need to get soldiers together, like now is the time. And then he started talking about his travels in Europe. In France, Maguire had met with the members of the far-right paramilitary veterans group, La Croix de Feu, the Cross of Fire. In Italy, he had met with Mussolini.
Oh my God.
And was impressed by the loyalty and the power of his black shirts. Mm-hmm. And then in Germany, of course, you know, he met with the Germans.
Yeah.
Wink, wink, we all know what that means. Uh-huh. So it was time for him. So the general asked, like, how he intended to pull off this really involved coup of, like, 500,000 veterans. Like, who's going to pay for this? Again, Butler was stringing him on to get more and more information. Yeah. Like, who's going to pay for 500,000 soldiers to march on Washington? Maguire, he explained that a group, like his group, would be announcing their presence publicly soon. They were just deciding on a name of their organization, which is hilarious. Yeah. But he told Butler that collectively they had $300 million to commit to, quote, protecting the Constitution with fascism. Maguire went on to say that it didn't matter if Butler agreed or not. Once they got in touch with the right people in the American Legion or the VFW and acquired weapons, it was only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And they already had the heir to the Colt 45 fortune, We were so close to fascism, you guys.
Yeah.
Like, so close. So once again, he asked Butler to think about it because they really wanted him because they knew that the power that he could potentially wield. So Butler was scared after hearing about him meeting with the French and the Italians and the Germans. He reached out to a friend at the VFW and told him, like, dude, I'm being recruited by these Wall Street execs. They want me to do fascism for them.
Yeah.
And his friend is like, yeah, I've been hearing the same thing. So they were reaching out to different people, different veterans in the organization, trying to find just a person who could launch this whole thing. So it wasn't just Butler. The two of them, they talk, and their whole thing was that it was still a rumor. Mm-hmm. Like, they felt that they couldn't confidently go to the authorities at this point because they really didn't have a lot of proof. Uh-huh. There was a lot of hearsay and, like, you know, who's going to believe them? Like, you're saying bad things about J.P. Morgan. Like, no one's going to believe you.
Yeah.
Kind of thing, sadly. Before
they could have, they don't have, like, microphones with
recorders exactly. and stuff. Exactly. So he's just like, this is just a rumor. Like, keep holding on. Keep getting more dirt on them. Mm-hmm. Just now is not the time. However, when a group of conservatives calling themselves the American Liberty League went public, any notion that this was a rumor was just gone because it was all of the people that he had already been in contact with were in this group. It was Colonel M.P. Murphy who gave the first check. It was Robert S. Clark, the singer guy. It was John W. Davis who wrote the quote-unquote speech that he was supposed to be giving at this conference he wasn't invited to. And just other people that Maguire had mentioned in passing, everyone was in this group. Every single person was in this group. And these members were just like a who's who of like business elite. And get this, their stated purpose was protecting the Constitution. So Butler, after this, he felt like he had enough to go to someone else.
Sure.
So he, again, because he's from Pennsylvania and not Hawaii, he found a reporter at the Philadelphia Record, a man named Paul French. He tapped him and he told him what was going on and asked him, like, hey, can you, like, help me?
Yeah.
And this guy's like, yeah, I'll help you collect evidence. So Butler introduced French as just, like, a friend of his who was, like-minded.
Okay.
And Maguire just started spilling all the tea, and even more so to French than him. And I think it's maybe because French was a investigative journalist and like knew the questions to ask. Because it's just like, why is he telling you all these things? So I have a few quotes. So according to French, Maguire told him that we need a fascist government in this country to save the nation from the communists who want to tear it down and wreck all that we have built in America. The only men who have the patriotism to do it are the soldiers. And Smedley Butler is the ideal leader.
He's still trying to fuck with Smedley Butler. No means no.
But everyone loves him. That's the thing. And they want like all half million veterans to come out and overthrow the government.
I love that he literally said, like, we want to be fascists.
Oh, yes. He says fascism over and over again.
Unbelievable.
But it wasn't a bad word.
Yes.
Because this is before Hitler really did his thing, like really got in there.
Uh-huh.
It was a popular way of governing.
Sure, yeah.
Or it seemed like a model to almost be aspired to.
Good golly.
Like, it's totally a different connotation than today. Maguire also said that a dictator who would come galloping in on his white horse, either through the threat of armed force or the delegation of power and the use of a group of organized veterans to save the capitalist system.
Shit.
Yeah. He's just saying all the things. So while French and Butler were building a case against Maguire, who's just like literally telling all of the secrets about him and his like big business co-conspirators, the general was subpoenaed because word had got back through the veterans organizations. Like, word had gotten back to the FBI, and they're just like, people are talking.
Yeah.
People are talking about fascism, and they're talking about Butler in these conversations. Yeah. Like, what the fuck is going on? So he had to testify. Him and French, they testified before the Special Committee on Un-American Activities.
Okay.
You're going to love the way this ends. French and General Butler, they testify to everything that they know. They bring out all of the receipts. And they bring in Maguire, and they're just like, dude, like, what have you to say to all of these charges of fascism? And you're trying to overthrow the government? Like, pray tell. Maguire says that they're making up lies about him. And it's all untrue.
Uh-huh.
And that he never tried to buy Butler's compliance with a coup to overthrow the government. Never. Not once. Thankfully, Butler had the receipts, these postcards that he was sending.
Ooh.
He sent them from France, Germany, and Italy, talking about how he is watching these fascist groups and meeting with fascist leaders. And he had no explanation. He had nothing. He couldn't defend himself to that point. Because he said he was on a family vacation.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, why were you writing about the Croix de Feu on a family vacation? Why were you talking about the black shirts on a family vacation? And he had nothing to say. And also, he had no explanation for the $20,000 that went missing from his account during the same time that Butler said that he had thrown him that $18,000.
Gosh.
So I forgot to mention that the $18,000 were $18,000 bills. Back when $1,000 bills were a thing.
Oh, my Lord.
That was the money that he was shown. Show me the money.
$1,000 bills.
$1,000 bills.
How do you spend a $1,000 bill? What do you do with a $1,000
bill? Not at the bodega.
Yeah.
Unless you're buying like a car. And I don't even know how much
even then, back then, a car cost like $700 or
something.
Oh,
well, never mind. So he couldn't account for this missing money at all. And he couldn't really defend these postcards that were produced in his own hand. So in the end, it was only Maguire that was called before this committee. Robert S. Clark, he lived in France at the time. It could not be reached. Colonel Murphy and John W. Davis were available. Never called.
Mm-hmm.
Never called. Nor were any of the other suspected conspirators. No one other than Jerry Maguire testified.
Imagine having a hearing without calling any witnesses.
Right? Meanwhile, this same committee is convicting people over thought crimes.
Yeah.
So when the court report was published, it affirmed that the plot was real because there was enough evidence to show that it was real. The committee still never released a report to the public, but it told Congress that, this is a quote, it had received evidence that certain persons had made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient. All of the names of the accused and the American Liberty League itself were redacted.
Mm-hmm.
Redacted from the record. It was covered up. On March 25th, 1935, Jerry Maguire suddenly died of pneumonia.
Okay.
Yeah. His wife blamed General Butler for the lies he told about him.
What?
His wife didn't know. She just knew that he was dragged before the Committee on Un-American Activities, mm-hmm. and that after that, like, he was really stressed out. But the dude got pneumonia and died. He was only 37.
I mean,
he was already, but yeah, people died of pneumonia all the time.
Good, because clearly there were not going to be any fucking consequences otherwise.
No.
So good.
Yeah. So Butler went on to publish a book called War is a Racket that same year. And this is a quote from his book. I spent most of my time as a high class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism.
Holy shit.
He did feel vindicated that the committee affirmed what he had already knew to be true, but he was pissed that he had named names and they were all redacted.
Yeah, that's fucked.
He really thought he was doing a good thing and like people would be prosecuted.
Why were they redacted?
He went on to say, this was at a radio interview the following year. He said, like most committees, it slaughtered the little and allowed the big to escape. Mm-hmm. The big shots weren't even called to testify.
Mm-hmm. I had a feeling that that was going to be the outcome from the beginning. So I didn't have my hopes up that there were going to be any consequences.
I mean,
for
it's
this,
the reason why we don't know now, because yeah. It's like it was just swept under the rug. Butler, he spent the rest of his life trying to draw attention to the ties between big business and the American military. He died of pancreatic cancer in June of 1940. He was only 58 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. The committee said that the names were kept under wraps until they could be properly investigated. But no further investigation ever took place.
Of course. That's such bullshit. Because what was to stop them from trying again?
Exactly. The answer is nothing.
I could see an argument, not that this is right, but I could see an argument that like the FBI would say, we have an eye on these people. We're watching them to make sure they don't try again. But because capitalism is so important to our foundation that it would be destabilizing to release these names.
Yes. So that's what historians are speculating.
Yeah.
I read an article by a journalist named John Buchanan. He was speaking to the BBC in 2007. He said that it was probably because Roosevelt struck a deal with the traitors. Mm-hmm. His words. Roosevelt struck a deal with the traitors. They could avoid treason charges and possible execution if they backed off their opposition to the New Deal. He speculated that the press may have ignored the report at the urging of the government, which didn't want the public to know how close we were to fascism.
Yeah.
So this event was immediately written out of history, as most ugly truths are. But we could have been a fascist country, like entering World War II, if it wasn't for Smedley Butler.
That is wild.
Our raggedy little republic was saved by a man that no one knows. Like, everyone needs to put some respect on Smedley D. Butler's name. Like, he is a real one. He fucking saved us.
Holy cow.
He saved us.
We need, like,
we need all the schools to be renamed after him.
Seriously. There should be statues. Like, what an amazing person to just be like,
yes.
I'm against this, but I'm not going to tell you that just yet.
Yes. I'm going to say no firmly because I don't want to go to jail. But, sure. Like, I'm going to string you along so you implicate yourself. And eventually he thought that they would all go to jail
because they should have.
Yeah. I was surprised. You're saying you weren't surprised
that there were no consequences? No, this is America.
Yeah.
Rich people don't have consequences.
But fascism.
That's why.
I know.
That's why we're talking about cancel culture today, because cancel culture is consequences. And these people don't think that they should have consequences because they never have before.
Yes.
That's all cancel culture
is. You're so right. Consequences. Whoa. That blows my mind. Like,
rich
boiling
people don't
it down,
have consequences
don't have
for
consequences.
Their actions.
Yeah. That's a fact. Yeah.
If you renamed it
distilled
consequence
down consequences.
Culture, that's what it is. It's consequence culture.
God.
Consequences? I'm a rich white man. What are consequences?
Yeah. The end.
Fuck.
Right? The business plot, you guys.
Yeah.
No one has learned this with good reason because it's so inflammatory.
If the papers were to publish an article saying like, Singer,
DuPont, Maxwell House, Standard Oil, Chase Bank, JP Morgan
had just literally tried to overthrow the government. Can you imagine how destabilizing that would be if everyone all of a sudden hated every major corporation in America?
Yeah. But they own the newspapers.
There we go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They own the newspapers.
America.
When I first heard about this story, I'm like, no, this didn't happen. This seems like a conspiracy. And it was a conspiracy. Conspiracies are true.
Yeah.
Like this one. Like these people conspired to overthrow the government.
How have I never heard this before?
America.
I know.
I only heard it. I heard it on a podcast, and they weren't. They said it in passing, and I'm just like, "What?
Excuse me?
Yeah." They were talking about Prescott Bush, and it mentioned that he was involved in this business plot, and I'm just like, "Business plot? What is that?" I hit pause, and I Googled, and like my mouth was on the floor.
Incredible.
Right.
Well, on that note, our delicious, delicious. Sweet and spicy drinks.
It's so good. You need to go and find like some pressed ginger juice.
I mean, if you can't, just make the simple syrup. It's not going to be as spicy as it should
be.
It's still going to be delicious.
Oh, it's so good.
It's still going to be delicious.
This is like my favorite drink.
I can't wait till bars open again.
I know.
We can go to the bar. I mean, technically, they're open.
Yeah.
But I'm not going.
I hope I'm not weird at bars.
Oh, it's going
to
be weird.
Because I think it's going to be weird to be around others.
It's going
to
be weird.
Which is so...
We'll get used to it.
Yeah.
It's going to take a bit, but we'll get used to it. But it's going to be weird
I react in such a violent... Not a violent way, but like such a pronounced way when I see someone who's like not wearing a mask around me. I'm just like...
Oh, when I watch TV...
Oh, yeah. No, that's weird.
Freaks me out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm watching something from 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And we're like, what? Why are they not wearing a mask?
Yeah, it's so strange.
Yeah. But anyways, our drinks are empty.
Yes.
Because they're so damn delicious.
Sure are.
America's history is juicy. We just add two different kinds of scotch and some spicy ass ginger juice.
Mm.
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
We are signing off.
Yes.
And we are saying thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you to Tim Clough, our sound engineer and podfather.
We're bowing and we're making that weird gesture with our hands.
circles with your hand. We could not do this without you. And we couldn't do this without our audience.
Yes.
Who makes it all worthwhile.
Affirmative.
Yes, affirmative. Okay.
Bye. Bye. 'Beyond Reproach' is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.